This is the State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow. The European Green Belt is a strip of land stretching north to south for thousands of miles. Today, it's thriving with different ecosystems. During the Cold War, the strip was a no-man's land that divided the Soviet bloc from the West. It was mostly fences, landmines, and other obstructions designed to keep people out, but that didn't stop wildlife from flourishing. It became one of the many places that accidentally turned into a nature preserve because of the Cold War. Joining me now is Lisa Brady. She's an environmental history professor at Boise State University and studies how the Cold War influenced conservation. Lisa Brady, welcome to the State of Things.
Thank you very much, Frank, for having me.
Tell us more about this Cold War conservation. Tell us what was happening in those little strips of land that separated east from west.
Well, the Iron Curtain there in Europe was, as you've already mentioned, a place where human development, residential development, commercial development, industrial development, all of those things were kept at bay. And so nature in its various forms, either animal or plant, had a lot more opportunity to thrive and reproduce and sort of take over the land for itself. And this is a really important thing, I think, as a legacy of the Cold War, which I would suggest is one of the most destructive conflicts in human history, largely because of the nuclear testing at the center of it. But it's also one that has enabled places all around the world to protect nature that came out of these strange no man's land areas, borderlands that were created because of Cold War politics and Cold War animosities.
And as you say, environmental protection was not the primary concern here, but it was, one of the outcomes. So give us a sense of how much ground we're talking about and where these places are.
Well, it covers hundreds of thousands of acres. The Green Belt in Europe would be several thousand miles long, all the way from northern Finland in its border with Russia, all the way down through what used to be the border between East and West Germany and into the Balkans. And so it really is an incredibly long, it's narrow, but it's an incredibly long strip of land that has become a constellation, if you will, of transboundary and national parks. In addition to that, then you have the Korean DMZ, which is only about 0.5% of the total landmass of the Korean Peninsula, but it is an incredibly important 0.5%. And then in addition to that, we've got the U.S. bases. They're the ones that I'm most familiar with through my research. U.S. bases, both in the mainland and in U.S. territories like Puerto Rico, where Cold War bases have now become national wildlife preserves.
Well, let's talk about one of those in the U.S., the Rocky Mountain Arsenal, which has since become a wildlife refuge. But tell us about its history.
Well, the Rocky Mountain Arsenal and the Rocky Flats plant, both just outside of Denver, Colorado, really were fashioned right during the Cold War at the end of the mid-1940s and into the 1950s to develop nuclear weapons and other types of weapons for use during the Cold War. And these are fairly significant tracts of land that, as I already mentioned, precluded any other kind of development on them. Now, they were incredibly polluted due to the weapons testing and the weapons creation, nuclear weapons, chemical weapons, those kinds of things. But since they have been closed since the late 1990s, early 2000s, they too have reverted to nature preserves that at first were accidental. They weren't officially recognized. But now they are this wonderful greenway between Denver and Rocky Mountain National Park, where there is hiking and biking and nature trails and bird watching and all sorts of things like that.
What about the legacy, though, of the toxic substances that were there? Are we seeing animals that don't belong there? Are there some that were there and would never return? Tell us what we find there today.
Well, most of the plants and animals that are found in those areas are endemic to the region. That is in part on purpose and in part just through sort of natural ecological cycling. but we aren't seeing, you know, three-eyed fish or five-horned, five-antlered deer or anything like that. We don't have that kind of strange animal life. But one of the things that allows these plants and animals to thrive is that the Rocky Mountain Arsenal was and Rocky Flats plant were Superfund sites. And so they were required by law to be remediated. And so most of the pollutants have been removed or somehow taken out of the system in order to make it a clean system for plants and animals and, of course, people who are there as visitors.
You also looked at U.S. bases in Puerto Rico. What does conservation look like there?
Well, the Vieques Island was a naval not a proving ground, sorry.
A base, right? Wasn't it a base?
Base, yep, yeah. Yep. It was a naval base. And it, too, was a Superfund site. And the U.S. Navy has been responsible for cleaning that up. And since 2001 and 2003, there are two separate national wildlife refuges on Vieques Island. The largest one is in the east at about 14,000 acres and a much smaller one on the west. And Vieques is actually one of the primary nesting grounds and habitat areas for the green sea turtle, which is on the endangered species list. So it's a really vital place for the protection of that particular species, as well as any number of other marine and terrestrial species.
What about here in North Carolina, Fort Bragg, for instance?
Yeah, Fort Bragg is an interesting place. It's not directly related to the Cold War insofar as these others that I have researched that were actually created during the Cold War and for the purposes of developing national security and weapons systems for that particular conflict. Fort Bragg, as you well know, was created in 1918. But it has on its own, in its own way, has attempted to become a really vital and vibrant ecological place. The base itself has created no-mow zones and has planted native flowers for the southeastern region and has been really successful at that and won the Army Sustainability Award in 2008, which was the first ever awarded.
Now, so this is a direct effort and intention on the part of a military base to do this, unlike some of the other places that have just been converted from demilitarized zones to green spaces. What was behind the thinking in applying these ecological principles to what is still an active military base?
Well, there are, I think, two purposes to this. One is cost cutting. If you don't have to pay landscapers to mow areas and they can grow back into a natural habitat, that cuts costs. And that is a laudable endeavor. But the other thing is, and here's where I think Fort Bragg does connect to the Cold War. One of the outcomes of the Cold War, I suggest, is, and others suggest too, is that this is the rise of the environmental movement. As people saw what was happening with air testing and with military exercises going on almost constantly, there was a fear that military developments were going to irremediably harm the environment. And so the environmental movement, the modern environmental movement, really gets going in the 1950s, 1960s in response to the Cold War. And I would suggest that the United States military at Fort Bragg and at other places has really responded to the demands, the requests, the expectations of environmentalists to play the role of good steward, even as they are doing their very necessary work of working for national security.
Well, I want to take us back to Europe during the Cold War and that artificial line that Winston Churchill dubbed the Iron Curtain. That was actually a very real space, and it became this kind of demilitarized zone between the two. What are some of the features of that area now? Some of the stranger features. I understand that there are some animals that still don't venture into that territory, right?
That is one of the most fascinating stories to me. About 10 or 15 years ago, the Washington Post published a story about a particular red deer that would not cross the former fence line between Germany and the Czech Republic. And there have been a number of scientific studies. In fact, there's one in just in 2012 in mammalian biology that has tried to understand that process. Is this a biological process? Is this a behavioral process? Now, that study in mammalian biology couldn't either confirm or refute that it was, in fact, still happening, that the red deer weren't crossing that former fenced border zone. But genetics seem to suggest that there is some genetic drift between the populations on either side of the former fence. So it's really fascinating to think that animals got habituated to the human-drawn lines and have sort of adapted and evolved since then.
And we're still keeping the reds out. So, I mean, there's that.
Yes, that's right. The red deer.
That's it. It's a holdover from the Cold War days. What about this? It's a rare piece of ground that we're talking about. I mean, because it's not very wide and therefore can be overflown and overrun by all kinds of flora and fauna that don't really respect our political borders. Is there anything that we can tell from this now, looking at this little swatch of ground that was protected from human footfalls, that would tell us something about what was going on in that period or environmental protection in general?
Well, from an ecological perspective, it would be difficult to say that this green belt somehow resembles a pre-Cold War nature, just as in the Korean DMZ. The area had, of course, been heavily populated, not heavily populated, but heavily managed by humans prior to and during the Cold War. And so we can't say that this is sort of a reflourishing of pre-Cold War ecology. But I think what it does demonstrate is that nature has a real resilience, even in the face of human pressures and even in the face of human decision making. So I guess what it really symbolizes to me is this idea that nature is this living entity that we really need to pay attention to.
Is it? And it's also interesting. I mean, you talked about the fact that in the middle of the Cold War was really the rise of the environmental movement. And as you say, though, it wasn't the intention of the Cold Warriors to protect nature. This was one of the unintended consequences. I mean, are there ways in which we can also look at some of the more destructive aspects of Cold War? Obviously, the worst didn't happen. But a lot of ground was devoted to, you know, the storage of toxic substances and that kind of thing. Is there any way that we can kind of weigh these two things against each other?
Absolutely. Yeah, as I mentioned, the Cold War was perhaps the most destructive environmentally. It destroyed entire islands in the South Pacific. You look at many of the atolls where the French and where the United States and others did their above-ground nuclear testing. And these are areas that are either uninhabitable today, the Marshall Islands in particular, the Bikini Atoll, which is where the United States did a number of its major tests. There had been human communities there that had lived there for generations, and they are no longer – well, they have been allowed back onto the island in the last 15 to 20 years, but the vegetation was destroyed, the fisheries were destroyed, the lagoon that had incredible cultural importance to the local peoples was destroyed. And so even in just one atoll in the South Pacific, you can see a complete destruction of a culture and of landforms. And the same, I would say, would go for places like Nevada, where there were the numerous above-ground testing nuclear tests in the 1950s and 60s, which had even larger implications through airborne nuclear isotopes, which I live in Boise, Idaho, and near here is Emmett, a small town that has an excessively high rate of thyroid cancer, which has been connected to the downwinder syndrome, which is exposure to these radionuclides.
Conversely, we can see that military bases, I mean, getting back to Fort Bragg, are learning that there are some reasons why being environmentally conscious is a benefit, particularly if you're trying to preserve various habitat for training maneuvers. And if you need to have a desert habitat or forest habitat, you need to protect that, I guess, from encroachment. So this becomes, conversely, another reason why the Defense Department wants to find itself in the environmental protection business, I guess. Is that right?
Absolutely, right. When you can expect or when you're planning to perhaps be engaged in military activities in any number of ecosystems or landscapes, having them on your home turf that you can then use for training purposes, of course, is to your benefit. Absolutely.
Lisa Brady is an environmental history professor at Boise State University, and she's going to give a talk tomorrow at Duke University in Durham about the Cold War's effect on conservation. Lisa, thank you so much for talking with us.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
You can find out more about Lisa and her work at our website, stateofthings.org. Our program is produced by Anita Rao, Charlie Shelton Ormond, Laura Pelliser, and Jennifer Brookland. Robin Copley is our technical director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.